This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. And our guest this afternoon is award-winning journalist Charlene Hunter-Gault, currently a special correspondent on Africa for NPR. She's also reported for The New Yorker, The New York Times, PBS, and CNN. Hunter-Gault has spent much of the last decade living and working in Africa. Now she's the author of a book in which she shares with readers what Africa is to her. She describes it as a modest attempt to capture the moment of a continent in motion. The title of the book, New News Out of Africa, Uncovering Africa's Renaissance. The book looks at the transformation of South Africa, the struggles of sub-Saharan nations, and the portrayal of Africa by foreign journalists and African journalists. Listeners, I invite your questions and comments this afternoon for our guest, Charlene Hunter-Gault. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, if it would be a long-distance call, call us toll-free. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Charlene Hunter-Gault is the recipient of several honors, including two Peabody Awards and two Emmy Awards. She's the author of In My Place, a memoir of the civil rights movement and her experience being one of the first two black students to attend the University of Georgia. Her new book, New News Out of Africa, Uncovering Africa's Renaissance, is published by the Oxford University Press. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Charlene, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. Sorry you're going to be in the rain.
Yeah, it comes with this time of year. You know, Africa, when I think of Africa, I think of a continent that is so immense. It is so diverse. It is at once rich and poor. What has it been like for you over the course of more than two decades now exploring it?
It's a very fascinating place to be. It is, as you say, it's a continent of 800 million people, and it's a multifarious continent. You know, one of the things that often comes up here in America is people say, what is that country like? And I said, no, it's a continent. You know, in sub-Saharan Africa, 48 countries, 54 in total. But it's just fascinating because there's so many cultures, so many languages, so many different kinds of existences. In South Africa, for example, there are 11 official languages, and that in and of itself is fascinating. But the cultures, from the Zulus to the Xhosas to the Tswanas and Pedis and Vendas, and then you go to other countries like Nigeria, and you have an extremely different kind of country in the north, where you have mostly Islamic peoples than from the south, but you also have many cultures and tribes in that country. And as you say, you have extremes of poverty. I think the overarching problem on the continent is, in fact, poverty. But in South Africa, you have what was once described to me as first world and third world. You have a modern industrial economy and you have cities like Cape Town, which everybody wants to go to because it's so beautiful, and Johannesburg, which is like any urban city in America, and Durban, which is another urban center. And then you have these extreme poverty locations, even 5 minutes from Johannesburg. So it's just a rich continent with many, many challenges and also many, many satisfactions of living there.
Hmm. You say in your book, you think international journalists need to come into Africa. They need to come in right. Tell us how you first heard that phrase, and what does coming in right involve, and what does it involve in terms of working in Africa?
Well, I see you've read the book. years ago, when I was working for the New York Times in the early 70s, and the Black Panther Party had just tried to change its image of a violent, violent party into one that was feeding children, having children's breakfast programs, and so on. I went to Harlem to cover a press conference, and I asked the Young Black Panther, well, when he asked me for my credentials, I told him, showed him my press card. He saw New York Times. He said, oh, no, you can't come in here. You work for the man, meaning the white man, downtown. And I said, well, but have you ever... He said, and the man's not going to let you tell the truth. And I said, well, have you ever read anything I've written? And he said he hadn't. I said, well, look, let's make a deal. Let me come in and cover this press conference, and if what you read in the New York Times tomorrow isn't an accurate reflection of what went on here, don't let me in the next time, but don't bar me this time. So he said, okay, I'll make a deal with you. You can come in, but you have to come in right. And what he meant by that was check your predispositions at the door, and come in and let the circumstances determine what you write. And I think that that's a good lesson for us, no matter what we cover, whether it's in America or Africa or anywhere else, that you come in without a prejudgment and function as a good journalist would. You know, let the facts determine what you write about.
Mm. Now, in the first chapter of the book, you mention Du Bois and double consciousness. The two-ness of being an African-American, it's something you've thought about while working in Africa. So how do you come in right as an African-American?
Well, I think that, you know, I have always had problems with the term objectivity as it relates to journalists, because I know that that's one of the, you know, general tenets that are taught in journalism schools, etc. But, you know, we're all creatures of our environments, of our backgrounds, and we are going to see things through the prism of our own experience, even as we try to present as journalists fair and balanced reports. So going to Africa, and especially South Africa, where so many of the struggles against apartheid reminded me of our own struggles against the Jim Crow South in the United States, I see so many things through that prism. I tend to see the black majority as having been deprived for so many years of their full humanity and their full civil rights, just as we were in the American South up until the civil rights movement of the 60s. And so I just have a natural affinity and sympathy, if not empathy, for those people. And so when it comes to the issue, for example, of affirmative action, which is, you know, affirmative action involving policies designed to make up for past discrimination, I'm totally sympathetic. And in South Africa, affirmative action is called black economic empowerment. And it's not a dirty word, as it's become here in the United States. It's government policy. And so, you know, the there might be some debate about the impact of this, say, on the white minority, but in general, this is government policy, and a black-led government ensuring that the people who were denied all those years by the white minority do, in fact, have methods and means to enter the economic mainstream. So those are things that I'm sympathetic to, which doesn't mean, of course, that when things go wrong with the policy, when it is, it may be abused or whatever, I'm not immune from writing removed from writing critical stories about it. But just in the first instance, my sympathies go in that direction. Just as in the first instance, my sympathies are with poor people and the efforts that they're trying to make to get out of poverty all over the continent.
Yeah. How do you strike the right balance? Maybe you can give us an example of how you find the right approach to a story?
Well, I guess it all depends on the story. I mean, you know, I was in Mozambique during those awful floods of several years ago, and I think most Americans probably saw that baby, the woman who had the baby in the tree. That was the big headline and visual here on American television. Well, subsequently, I went there, and I met a family who had also almost been caught up in the flooding. And they had to escape to the roof of a house because the waters were coming so fast. And the woman was pregnant, and within a short time after they got to the roof of their house, she gave birth first to one baby, and then, lo and behold, to everybody's surprise, a second baby. And they were up there on that roof with their neighbors who had helped with the delivery for several days. And in the process, one of the babies died. And when I found the family, I think there were three or four other children and the wife, and they were in a refugee center at a church near the Capitol. And I said to the father, who was a minister, "What does something like this do to your faith in God?" And he said, "Oh, it has strengthened my faith, because God could have taken all of us, and he took only one." Well, you see, there's no other side to that story, and you don't even have to make a judgment. Mm-hmm. You just write that one the way it was. But then you have a lot more stories, you know, especially dealing with government officials and things like that, where you – or let's take the example I just gave you of the black economic empowerment. Mm-hmm. There's been a criticism in South Africa that the business of black economic empowerment, the big deals where banks and other financial institutions and large corporations have, in fact, begun to take on black partners, but that they tend to be the same politically connected blacks over and over again. And that has been a huge debate in South Africa. Well, in the book, as well as in my general reporting, I've told both sides of the story, or all three sides. I mean, I've told the story of the government efforts to make up for past discrimination, but I've also told the story of those who have been among the six who have received most of the deals. And then I've told the stories of the critics, and one of the critics is the president's own brother, who, you know, has certain ideological positions that tend to be at odds with his brother. And so I've told all three sides of that story. Now, that, again, is a question of fairness and balance, even though in the first instance I'm sympathetic to the principle. You understand what mm-hmm. I'm saying? I'm sympathetic to the principle of black economic empowerment, but here's a debate that has emerged, and it's not just white critics of it. It's black critics as well, but there are white defenders, and there are black defenders, and the people who actually have been the recipients of these contracts and deals, are people who deserve to have a voice. So I've tried to cover the bases on that, and again, you know, that goes back to fairness and balance as opposed to objectivity.
You went to South Africa first as a reporter in 1985 to cover the anti-apartheid movement, and you say on your first assignment there in 1985, South Africa filled the old news bill. Now, the title of this book is New News,
right?
Out of Africa. Talk with us, if you would, about the difference between Africa's old news bill and the new news.
Well, of course, in 1985, this was the darkest days of the apartheid regime and its opposition, and the regime was extremely brutal and violent in its attempt to suppress the black majority, and the black majority were rising up. And so the reporting was really just sort of the cliches, I call it, of apartheid. You had the white oppressors and the black victims, and every day there was some violent confrontation or clash, or almost every day. And you know, it was the it feel that where if it bleeds, it leads. Well, there was a lot of blood and violence, and so, you know, those were dramatic stories that have always been the standard fare of journalistic coverage, especially on the continent. So in my view, that's sort of the old news. Part of the old news is what I call the four D's of the African apocalypse: death, disease, disaster, and despair, because that's the prism through which most of the Western media view Africa. The new news is different from that, in that while it might have to cover death, disease, disaster, and despair, and there's certainly an abundance of all of the above on the continent, there are other stories within those stories that aren't necessarily just gloom and doom. There's stories of people battling heroically to help with the AIDS epidemic. There's stories of people who are making headway in poverty with the assistance often of international aid agencies. You know, there are more. I'm not saying that every story about Africa has to be a positive story, but again, one that reflects realities on the ground. I've often said that, you know, the African journalists are trying to take control of their own stories so that they can have more stories in which they are recognizable to themselves. I mean, there are human beings there, as well as problems. And I think the new news is news that I'm saying reflects on not just the four D's, but the context in which those four D's exist, and also other things outside of that context.
Yeah. So new news is all about context.
It's about context, but in terms of the African continent, it is news that breaks out of that stereotypical kind of reporting that only looks at the negative, the Afro-pessimism, if you will.
Yeah. I'd like to ask you a question that it may not be possible to answer or answer easily, but here goes. Can you give us some sense of how Africa is covered by African journalists?
Oh, that's not a difficult one at
okay.
all. African journalists are indeed trying to take control of their own space, their own stories, their own portrayals. They face tremendous challenges, not least being that so many of them don't have the resources to, say, have computers. I mean, but thankfully, in many places now, they have internet cafes that journalists can use, but they don't have, you know, their own individual computers. Increasingly, while you still have some repression on the continent, I'm on the Committee to Protect Journalists, and we're often reporting on the continuing repression of journalists by governments that don't believe in independent journalism. But at the same time, you also have a new news in that even the state-owned media, which is the majority on the continent, are starting those reporters who work for the state-owned media are, in some cases, becoming a little bit more independent, a little more balanced in their reporting, not just regurgitating the party line. Of course, that's still, you know, we have a long way to go on that. But there are a growing number of independent journalists on the continent, and they are finding their sea legs. We, when I work for CNN, I was a part of a judging panel that solicited contributions from all over the continent from journalists. And initially, they were slow in coming, but over the years, this has grown. And my colleagues who are still working on that tell me that you can see the incremental improvement in not only the way in which the reports are done, but the content. You know, it used to be that they wouldn't take on anything controversial, or they felt as new nations, working in new nations, their responsibility was not to write about anything negative. Well, now they're beginning to see the constructive role that criticism can play. And so there are far more stories being submitted that look at things critically. There's not a whole lot of coverage of crises like the AIDS crisis and stuff like that, but gradually they're beginning to tackle some of these thornier issues. And again, in some of the countries when they do that, the government comes down on them. But there are a growing number, like Ghana, for example, is a shining example of how journalists have grown and developed. And in the last two democratic elections there, journalists fanned out across the country and were there at when the ballots were counted and were phoning the results into their radio station so that transparency was guaranteed and hanky-panky kept at a minimum.
Hmm. What's the climate for journalism in parts of Africa that are more troubled, places like Rwanda or Sudan?
Well, Sudan, you hardly can even get into. I mean, I spent about 12, you know, almost 2 weeks waiting to, in Khartoum, for permission to get into Darfur, and it just was, they never said no, but it just wasn't forthcoming. So in areas like that, it's extremely difficult, although Lydia Pogrebin from the New York Times is there now doing a magnificent job, and some others have gotten in there. But it can be difficult. You know, getting into Zimbabwe nowadays is almost impossible because of the massive kinds of repression and difficulties that the government finds itself in. Inflation there is over 1,000%. People are unhappy with the leadership, but the government is trying to keep all of that under wraps by not permitting outside journalists to come in. And often it's outside journalists who can go in and ask the questions that the local journalists would be under severe pressure, if not threat of torture or arrest or even worse. So you have that, and then I was just in Ethiopia with a committee with two other members of the Committee to Protect Journalists, where you had about a dozen journalists in prison there facing death sentences, being charged with treason. For rising out of the last election there, where there was violence and some people did in fact die. And the government has accused these journalists of being a part of fomenting this trouble, saying that they were agents of the opposition. Now, I have said to the prime minister there, even if, let's say for the sake of argument, that they all were guilty of this, which they are certainly not. But even if they were, do they deserve the death penalty? So, you know, you have these kinds of things happening. I mean, and even the Prime Minister, Meles Zenawi, acknowledged that the relationship between the media and the government was poisonous. And we were able to talk to him. We haven't seen a lot of improvement since, but at least one of the journalists on whose behalf we appealed, the pregnant one, was in fact on humanitarian grounds released from custody. So, you know, again, my new news is not to say that everything is fabulous on the continent, quite the contrary, nor is it to say that all the news or the news should concentrate on being good. It should be good, but good in the sense that it's quality journalism, quality information that citizens, both Africans and non-Africans, can use as they assess what's going on the continent.
Hmm. Journalist Charlene Hunter-Galt is our guest here this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine. She has spent much of the last decade living and working in Africa. She is now the author of a book in which she shares with readers what Africa is to her. The title of the book, New News Out of Africa, Uncovering Africa's Renaissance. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments for our guest, Charlene Hunter-Galt. Give us a phone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener now in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I have a positive view of Botswana, not as a result of news, but as a result of Alexander McCall Smith's fiction about the number one ladies' detective agency. And I have no way of knowing if it's based on truth, but it's a largely positive view. Is your author familiar with this set of books?
Oh, absolutely. I must confess I haven't read them, although I see them lined up in the bookstores when I go into them in South Africa. And I know from friends of mine who read them that they are supposed to be really fabulous. And I have to say that Botswana is one of the bright lights on the continent. They have a strong democratic government. It's a small country, and so they're able to do things that some of the larger countries are not, because of all sorts of reasons, which I won't necessarily go into unless I'm asked to. But Botswana is manageable, and it is managing, and they have good governance. All of the signposts for for good democracy are there. They have a huge HIV and AIDS problem, but the government has been very good on, you know, using the international community's resources to make progress there. And you might want to know more about Botswana through some other vehicles than your fiction, but you're certainly not wrong in your impression that it's you know, that it's in the good guys column.
Well, that's great. You would probably feel pretty good about reading those books.
Okay, well, I take a lot of long plane rides, so maybe the next one I'll take one of them.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thanks
for the call. Other calls are welcome. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. 800-222-9455 is our toll-free number. That number, good if you're listening outside the Champaign-Urbana area and it would be a long-distance call for you. You can use the toll-free line, 800-222-WILL. Covering a continent as large as Africa, what do you read? How do you keep up with all that is happening?
You know, I don't make any pretense at covering the continent, but I do try and stay informed on, you know, my second chapter is called Baby Steps to a Democracy, Towards Democracy, and I do try to look at the steps that countries are taking as they move into what I refer to as the second wind of change. Harold Macmillan was in British Prime Minister Harold Macmillan in 1960 was speaking in the South African Parliament, and he talked about a new wind of change blowing across the continent, referring to the end of colonialism. And now I think there is a second wind blowing because Africans are talking about taking control of their own destiny, solving African solutions to African problems is one of the themes that they or mantras that they continuously repeat. And I think that you know, it's not too difficult to follow that through the media, through the internet. For example, allafrica.com is a great source of news from around the continent, and you can also go online and just Google things, which I often do if I'm looking. I'm going in a few days to Liberia to interview the new first mm-hmm. woman president on the continent, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, whom I've known for a long time. And I've just Googled, you know, the stories that have been written about her since she came to power. You know, there's no excuse these days for people not having information because there is just, as my son would say, a plethora of information out there. You just have to want to. And, you know, I think that when I inform myself, I inform myself as a consumer of news as well as one who purveys news, and it's not any different. I mean, you go to the sources that Google leads you to, or that other people lead you to, and then people nowadays, Africans are writing more books about themselves. Wole Soyinka just finished still the Nobel Nigerian Nobel laureate, and you know there are a lot of books that you might not even agree with. I mean, I'm hoping, for example, that my book will stimulate debate about the continent, which is a way of, again, making people aware. I'm sure that not everybody's going to agree with, you know, the things I say, maybe even with the entire framework, but at least it will get people talking. And there's some wonderful fiction, too. The lady mentioned the number one ladies' detective agency, and he's been writing a long time. But last year, I hosted the African American Institute dinner here in New York with an organization that has long been involved in the forefront of education for Africans. And one of the books they gave away was by a young Nigerian girl called The Icarus Girl. I think it was The Icarus Girl. And it was about, it was just a fantasy written by this 18-year-old girl. And it was just wonderful. And South Africans, there's one by a young man named Eric Moyene called Old Mandingo, the Only Black at a Dinner Party. And his is the voice of a new, younger generation of South Africans, some of them they call born frees, who were born after the end of apartheid, or certainly began to grow up in a freer South Africa. And he's dealing with the whole question of blacks who have now access to circles, social circles of whites and others, and often, he says he finds himself the only black at a dinner party, and people are sometimes surprised that he has a substantive comment to offer. But the flip side of that, he says, is that when you get to be the celebrity as the only black at the dinner party, and then you get upset when some other black shows up because they start to get all the attention. And while a lot of it is funny, he also makes a very serious point that black people who find themselves in positions where there've been no other blacks in the past mustn't just take that as a singular honor, but to reach back and ensure that they're doing everything they can to make sure that other blacks get into the same advancement queue, and also are able to take advantages of new opportunities. So there's a seriousness to it. And they're also making films. I mean, Futsi is a film that just won the Academy Award in the Best Foreign Language category. So that, you know, there's a lot out there. You just have to go and find it.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Charlene Hunter-Gault. I'm going to take another call here in just a moment, but first let me remind you that a severe thunderstorm watch is in effect for Clark, Coles, Cumberland, Douglas, Edgar, Moultrie, and Shelby counties in the WILL severe weather coverage area until 7 p.m. Central Time this evening. Let's talk now with a listener in Champaign County, Line 4. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I wanted to inquire about whether you're reporting about the anti-privatization movement in South Africa. I met a very dynamic woman a couple of different times at some anti-IMF World Bank meetings and told amazing stories of the activism and the solidarity, and also what's happening with a water company, I believe from France, is introducing virtually coin-operated meters where you have to go down and buy a card, which then you stick in your slot in your water meter, and it doles out, and so it's, you're sort of advance paying for your water. It sounds awful to me. And this woman comes over, sponsored by anti-IMF and World Bank. Now, we know that South Africa escaped a bloodbath at the transition, but they also negotiated deals that sort of put these structural adjustment programs in to their policy, not in the same way as the other African countries, but they have the same concerns. And I think there's a cauldron there boiling that we're not paying any attention to. And it's horrible to say it, but the transition was relatively smooth, but the kind of deals that were cut are quite having quite the same draconian effect, as perhaps not as bad as some of the other lesser developed countries. But I think you get my drift. I would like for you to comment on that. And are you talking to these sorts of people and reporting back on it? Is that the kind of story your editors want to see?
Well, you know, I don't work for anybody now. I mean, I freelance, and I do a lot of work for National Public Radio. I haven't done much on this particular issue, and it is a big debate. I mean, South Africa hasn't, as you say, been involved in the same kind of way as some of the other countries in the World Bank and IMF structural adjustment, which many Africans say set back efforts at education and health care, et cetera, et cetera. And I've talked to let me come back to that in a minute. Let me just say about the South African economy, the unions and the anti-privatization people and people like that will, in fact, make the argument that the kind of economic program the government adopted has not trickled down to the masses of black people, which is the majority. The masses are the majority in the country. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, South Africa has enjoyed the most, through fairly conservative economic policies, has enjoyed the best growth in its economy since the end of apartheid, long before the end of apartheid. That has been, of course, brought about, as you say, by very conservative economic policies. There has been a recognition, however, on the part of the government that they have to do more. I mean, they do have a program of black economic empowerment. They've been criticized for it being a program that has enriched only a few well-connected blacks, and that argument is thoroughly ventilated in my book. On the other hand, they're saying that they are now taking steps to broaden black economic empowerment so that it does come down to the small business people, that there is more attention paid to infrastructure, especially in the rural areas. And only time will tell. I mean, you've got a very active union movement, which has been opposed to a lot of the privatization, and they are certainly no shrinking violets in terms of bringing their views and issues to the attention of the public. And so, you know, only time will tell. I mean, one of the things that you have to, I keep saying that we have to look at, especially in terms of South Africa, is that this is a democracy that's only 11 years old and has only 11 years, in the last 11 years, emerged from being what Nelson Mandela calls the polecat of the world. And so, obviously, a liberation movement that took over 11 years ago and up to that point was seized with simply ending apartheid, not with running a government, is going to take some time to make some adjustments in policies that they say they want to have benefit the majority. You do have a bit of a ticking time bomb there, and that is in terms of particularly the vast numbers of unskilled workers, young people in particular, out there in the economy, outside of the economy, with no way of getting in. And that is going to require a lot of creativity in terms of trying to come up with programs that will bring them in. And I don't see anywhere in the world where you've been able to do that kind of massive change in a short period of time. That is a very long-term strategy, and so I think that, you know, the government is counting on the patience of the people until the policies that they're putting in place pay off. And who knows? I mean, we don't know where that's going to lead, because certainly while they've benefited millions of people who didn't have water or electricity, there are millions now who don't have to put coins into a meter. They have free water. They have toilets that run with running water, and they have electricity. Millions more do not. And then outside of South Africa, you also have countries that were put under severe structural adjustment. Tanzania, for example, had so many students in school being educated, and the literacy rate was quite high. Well, that dropped during the period under which the country was in structural adjustment. That is structural adjustment, meaning that you had to reorganize your whole economic program to make it much leaner and much meaner so that you could pay your debts and get out of debt. But now they've come out of this period of sacrifice, and Tanzania is back on the move towards bringing more students back into the economy, providing more social services, and concentrating on greater health care. So I think that, again, we have to look at where we are on the continent now and realize that while there are many, many problems that still exist, some of this tough medicine was not all to the bad.
Yeah. Is the listener
still
there?
Yeah, I'm still here. Okay. I'm not convinced. I think a lot of the tough medicine was absolutely atrocious. The idea of fee bases, this was the theory that fee base for education and healthcare would be a good thing, and it's been demonstrated how many fewer students went to school in Mozambique and other places obviously.
Yeah, no, I'm not making the case for it. I'm just telling you what the sides are saying about it. I mean, what the points of view are about it. I'm not trying to convince you because that's not my job. I mean, what I'm trying to do is just lay out, you know, some of the issues and some of the cases, and you know, I think the best journalism, and I could be wrong, is the journalism that produces news for people like you. I mean, news that people can use. And for those who feel as you do, there's information in here, but there's information on the other side. And ultimately, the people have to make up their minds. I mean, I've talked to leaders, including the former president of Tanzania, who talked about what a tough road they were having in meeting their structural adjustment targets. And at the time that I talked to him, he talked about being worried that the people weren't going to be patient because many of the things that anybody in a society wants, like good education for their children, decent health care, et cetera, they had to curtail in order to meet these targets. So, I mean, that's an ongoing debate, and I'm certainly not in a position to make a conclusion one way or the other, just to put the facts out there as I see them.
I want to thank the listener for his call. We only have about a minute or two left here in this portion of the program. And so to conclude, I would like to know, Charlene, what you think the responsibility is on the part of the international community to ensure that the baby steps, keep right on going and we, you know, we have a marathon runner pretty soon. You know?
Well, that's really important because now it's in the national interest of the United States and everywhere else that these countries do survive in a democratic way, because now we've got the threat of terrorism, we've got the prospect of poor people being victimized by people who might take advantage of their poverty to get them to do terrible things. So it's not just, you know, in the interest of doing good, but it's in the national interest that Africa succeed in becoming democratic and give a voice to its people. And I think that there are many ways in which the international community can help, but certainly having information that's good about the conditions is crucial. Getting more information about the continent, about how and where you can enter in terms of support. You know, there's a New York Times story not too long ago about famine in Niger, that was the last year, last spring, and they were complaining that the aid agencies were complaining that people weren't stepping up to help out in the situation. And I think one of the reasons for that is that they get a steady diet of this 4 Ds of the disaster, death, despair, and disease, and they figure, why bother if I'm only pouring money down a rat hole? Well, you know, international support does help. It helps in the fight against AIDS. It helps in the fight against poverty. It helps in reducing infant and maternal mortality, all the things that Africans are grappling with today. And even, you know, the Millennium Development Goals, one of which I've explored five of them, but one of them was, you know, increasing the number of girls in primary school up to a par with boys. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that Americans can support the development of Africa. And as I said, I think it's in the national interest.
And it's important we come in right.
Exactly.
And there we'll leave it. We're out of time. Charlene Hunter-Galt, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Celeste, thank you so much for having me.
My pleasure. Charlene Hunter-Galt is the author of New News Out of Africa, Uncovering Africa's Renaissance. The book is published by the Oxford University Press.